This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. On March 2nd through March 4th, 1,500 students from all over the world will descend on Washington, D.C. to attend LibertyCon, the annual meeting for Students for Liberty, or SFL. Active in 110 countries and hundreds of college campuses worldwide, the group is the leading organization working to educate, empower, and train the next generation of libertarian leaders and thinkers, people who are interested in maximizing individual autonomy and minimizing coercive policies that reduce free expression, lifestyle freedom, and economic rights. Today, I'm talking with Wolf von Lahr. He's the leader of Students for Liberty, about the big upcoming conference, what his group hopes to achieve in the coming year, and how the work he did for his PhD in political economy helps guide him in leading SFL. Wolf von Lahr, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much for having us. And your pitch about SFL was perfect. Maybe you should pitch us more often, Nick.
All right. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm looking forward to Reason is we're going to be out there in force, and we're always promoting SFL, which is a great organization. Why don't you start by giving a quick, thumbnail history of Students for Liberty?
Absolutely. So Students for Liberty was founded in 2008 by a roundtable discussion of a bunch of students that came together to just exchange notes, how to better organize their campus groups. Like, what are you doing? What speakers are you inviting? Like, what do you need help with? And out of that conversation, they organized the first conference we ever had, which was at Columbia University in New York. And nobody knew if it was going to be a success, and they were on the phone all the time, and there was like a blizzard coming in into New York, and nobody knew if like the people were actually showing up. But at the end of the day, over 100 people showed up to talk about the ideas of liberty and how to change American campuses. And even some international folks were there. And at that point, Alexander McCubbin, Sloan Frost, and others realized we need to really help these people and start an organization. And so Students for Liberty was born. And it was a very small operation, no funds. Alexander did everything from his own credit card. And now, 10 years later, we are an international movement. We have a budget of $4 million. We are active, as you said, in over 100 countries, and we're helping students worldwide. And even though, Nick, I have a strange name and a strange accent, right, over two-thirds of our funds are still directed at the U.S. because we were founded here, and it's the land of the free, and it's important that this is our main focus, but we do have many students fighting for the same principles abroad as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. You're originally from Germany, and you are kind of you in many ways embody globalization, don't you? You were born in Germany, you've lived all over the world and studied all over the world, and now you're running a student organization in D.C. What is the for LibertyCon, which used to be called the International Students for Liberty Conference, you know, that's coming up. What can attendees expect to find there? What's the pitch to have students from anywhere show up and also not just students, but people interested in liberty?
Absolutely. We have changed the name from ISFLC, International Students for Liberty Conference, which is very much a mouthful, to LibertyCon because we reflect a bigger audience. It is a meeting of minds, it's a meeting of generations, and it's a meeting of the movement. And so the audience is not only students, but a general audience, people within the movement, donors, etc. Even business people are coming there. And it's just to exchange ideas, to have a respectful and civil discourse, and really challenge one another. So we have debates about socialism, and we have an actual socialist there, who I have to give a lot of credit to, who comes there and debates Brian Kaplan on stage.
Who is the socialist?
Now you put me on the spot. Now I have to look it up. It's a journalist, and I can look at our program.
You jog my memory. It's Chris Hedges, a former New York Times reporter who went deep into the Occupy movement and whatnot. So that should be
exciting. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges.
Yeah.
And I should know that, but there's so much things going on with the conference, it's hard to keep track of that.
So
we have a debate on immigration, which is also a hot-button topic. So we also have over 60 partner organizations there, so you can really see the whole movement and different people working on different things. And, of course, one of the most important things is also to celebrate you. Reason has its 50 years anniversary this year, and, of course, Reason will be also a huge part of the conference. So all the listeners who are fans of Reason should check it out.
Yeah, it should be fantastic. And I love the idea of having debates. I mean, I know Reason has participated in almost all of the old ISFLCs, now LibertyCon. And it's always been fascinating because it's a large group of people. And as you were saying, you know, one of the things that I really love about the organization is that it's, you know, it's student based and in many ways it's student run. And it also reflects an interest for serious intellectual debate and conversation about the ideas that really matter to people. And so, you know, having not simply, you know, everybody kind of backslapping each other and just saying, oh, we've got it all figured out. But I think bringing in debates about socialism versus capitalism or command economies versus free enterprise, about immigration, these are, you know, this is the type of stuff that really takes it to the next level. Tell me this, what are the top issues for students? You know, what are they most passionate about, say, in the United States? And then, you know, what are the issues, how do the issues differ from country to country? And it's also kind of interesting to think about from continent to continent, because you guys, I don't think you have a chapter yet on Antarctica, but pretty much you're in every other continent, right?
Yeah, we are an all inhabited continent. So Antarctica, we have not tackled yet. But that's an excellent question. And it really differs, as you already mentioned, from country to country and from continent to continent. Starting in the United States, one of the most important topics, and we have spent significant of sums of that and a lot of training on that of our students, is about free speech. I mean, everybody's talking about that. You can see like some campus crazy story each night at Fox News or like other media outlets. And that's something our students are focusing on. Another thing is, of course, like the war on drugs and all the negative effects. Our students are focusing on that as well. But then you have like also the hard economic issues, debt, government debt, but also student debt, which is on the mind of most students because it's so outrageous in this country. When I tell some students here that I had savings after I came out of my master's degree, they cannot really comprehend it. And so these are the topics that they're talking about. And what I'm seeing on campus right now, especially to free speech, which is also like an interest of Reason, is that there is a lot of yelling going on. There's a lot of yelling in Congress, there's a lot of yelling in society, and there's a lot of yelling on campus. But I think our students have a different approach. We want to also to build bridges. And circling back to our conference, LibertyCon, we will have people from the left and from the right there and libertarians. And we want to have a civil discourse there. Yes, we wanted to challenge different people with different ideologies, but we want to build bridges. And our students are doing that as well. So we had events at the University of Ohio, the University of Maryland, where people came together and formed a coalition with the Students for Democracy or Students for Democratic Socialism, students from the right, students for Palestine, students for Israel, and they came together to talk with one another about free speech in a respectful way. And that really overcomes many barriers that people have in their minds, like, oh, the right is so evil, or libertarians are so bad and just want to see the poor stuff. And this really, really helps, and we see more and more of these activities. I'm excited about that.
It reminds me a couple of years, I think it was 2 years ago maybe or so, but I interviewed one of the members of Pussy Riot at your at ISFLC. And what was funny about it is that she was wearing a Bernie Sanders for President T-shirt. And, you know, and Bernie Sanders clearly is not a socialist, actually, in any sense of the word. I mean, he's a redistributionist, but he doesn't believe that the government should own all the means of production and whatnot. But it was fascinating to, you know, and I would never have had this opportunity elsewhere in any of my travels. But to be talking with a member of Pussy Riot who was defending the old Soviet Union by saying, oh, well, we didn't have socialism. We had state capitalism, which is the line to explain the failure of the economic system. But that's the type of event LibertyCon is, where you're milling around. You don't know exactly who you're going to run into, but it's going to be a great conversation. And I know that you have people coming, like Dave Rubin, who runs the Rubin Report, a really good, excellent talk show a conversation show on the web. People like John Mackey of Whole Foods, people like Patrick Byrne, I believe, of Overstock. I mean, thoughtful people who are interested in really expanding the scope of not just the libertarian movement, but also the types of people who define themselves as libertarian and what kinds of conversations we should be staging. What in You know, you do a lot in South America, and this is really fascinating because, and it's not to diminish at all the threat to free speech and, as importantly, free inquiry on American campuses because of what is often called political correctness. But, you know, through speech codes and through shouting down, not even, you know, we're not talking about when, you know, people bring somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos to campus and they're trolling and hoping for a police response. But, you know, when you're talking about places like Evergreen State College that, you know, attacked a professor for exercising his free speech rights and questioning a custom where an event that would have asked all white students to leave the campus, a liberal progressive who, you know, starts getting death threats from college students. That's all serious and it's important. But you guys also are working a lot with people in South America in particularly, you know, and there are places, I mean, like Venezuela, which does have a socialist economy, or in Brazil, which has a long and unfortunately almost unbroken succession of, you know, malignant political violence and whatnot. What are the top issues there? And how do your Students for Liberty members there work in those kinds of systems where they're really facing arrest or worse?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's also like a wonderful thing for our American students to see what international folks are facing in their respective countries. Here we are struggling on free speech on campus and people are being overly politically correct and shutting everything down. And you have more offensive speech than free speech or no speech at all. And that is tremendously bad, of course. However, if these people then learn, look, we have some students who stand up for press freedom in Russia and got kicked out of the country and have to live somewhere else because they would probably have been thrown in prison if they go back to their country. Or if you have like leaders in Venezuela who have been imprisoned because they asked questions during a government hearing and we had to pull people out of the country and spend our funds to really save them. And we have people who are standing up like Jorge Vasati, and I think you might have also interviewed him at some point. He lives now in Florida. Mm-hmm. He's Venezuelan. He goes to university here, but he cannot go back to Venezuela because he's a youth political leader with 100,000 people following on Twitter, speaking up against the awful regime in Venezuela and how detrimental it is to human flourishing, to free markets, to free speech. And he cannot go back. He cannot see his family. And if you interact with someone like that, and if our students interact with someone like that, liberty and the ideas become so much more than just complaining about the latest stupid thing that happened on a campus or this latest stupid regulation that came out of Washington, D.C. So I think that is something that really makes the ideas of liberty shine in a different light, and that's important.
Right.
But coming back to your question regarding Latin America, so one thing that is wonderful is, of course, what our folks have accomplished in Brazil. Brazil is one of our largest regions. We have thousands of leaders there, conferences with thousands and thousands of attendees, groups who are sometimes meet and they have like 500 people showing up. Imagine that, like a campus group, and you have like 500 people showing up just because they want to talk about the ideas of liberty. It's amazing. So we are not the only organization who's working on that. Of course, we had also the Atlas Network, who mm-hmm. has a huge play in that, which is phenomenal. But now it's really exciting. They soon have upcoming Senate elections, and many of our young people, classical libertarian, principled thinkers, now running for different offices. They are our alumni now. They're not working for us anymore, but they continue to affect change in that way. And using the leadership skills and the opportunities we have given them when they're part of Students for Liberty, now they can apply it in the public policy realm. And I'm excited about that. So topics they're focusing on is mostly like unions, cronyism, and corruption. Those are like the main topics, if I can broad brush Latin America in general and the Portuguese-speaking country, Brazil, and the Spanish-speaking countries.
You know, when it comes to student debt in the U.S., as well as I think in the, let's call them the OECD countries, but in, you know, in a large chunk of Europe and places like Japan, there's no question that college, you know, at least since kind of the end of World War II, college has become much more of a, particularly in the United States, it's a mass phenomenon now. Since about the early 70s, a majority of graduating seniors go on directly to some form of college. It, in you know, on average, it's about two-thirds of American high schoolers go on immediately to some form of higher education. It is expensive. I think from a free market point of view, we can kind of, you know, we can conclude, or we certainly believe that all of the amount of government aid of free and reduced price money to go to college helps increase the cost. We know this from, you know, kind of basic economics, that if you subsidize something, the producers of that good are probably going to raise their prices to soak up as much of that subsidy as possible. So that helps explain why students take out loans. You know, they have loans made available so they can go to college. The colleges raise their price. The returns to a college education are also good, so people are willing to pay it. But with student debt, how do you guys talk about that, and how do you confront that? Because it is a pocketbook issue, and certainly in the United States, you know, basic economic issues. How can I pay my bills? How can I get something more cheaply? You know, what is the solution to deal with things like student debt, or more generally, the rising costs of higher education?
Yeah, it's a complicated problem, and it's really a tough discussion because it has so many different facets to it. Of course, everyone likes education. It's very positively connoted. More education is always better, but people don't really apply economic thinking and diminishing marginal returns to this, that maybe not everyone should get like the maximum amount of education possible. So implicitly in your question, I thought you said also that maybe not everyone should go to college. And I would certainly agree with that if I heard you correctly. And often colleges are not providing like the education that someone needs. You know, we have like so many people going to social sciences, and do we need so many social scientists? Like, I am one, and I have all the degrees in the world, but I'm, maybe it sounds a bit hollow, but I would also maybe say like not everyone should get that education, you know? That is like one facet of it, but it's, since it's like so positively connoted, it's difficult to say that, because people say, oh, you're like anti-education, you just want people to fail. And no, but there are like different ways how people can get trained to have useful jobs, or not every job requires that. That's one part. The other part is it's a really complicated political economy behind that, meaning you have like subsidized debt from the government, and you can get student loans very cheaply, and you only think about, oh, I have to pay that only in 20 years. And so the incentives are aligned to go into debt now and to pay it like down the road. But people don't see the consequences of their actions that clearly in that moment. And then it's also prestigious to go to like a campus where you have like a pool and like really fancy dorms. And if I see like campus in the United States, like, wow, like why would you go there? Because it means that the prices would be like so much more expensive. But I can see that parents want the best for their children. The children want to have like a good education, a good consumption good there. And all of that makes it like very complicated. But I hope that there will be more of a market response. And I'm not sure why. Maybe you have like some thoughts to offer me, because I have to dig more into that myself. Like, why are there not like more cheap universities who have like a superior product in terms of education, maybe even faster, that comes up now? Like, more and more people understand right now that the Ivy Leagues are not that good anymore. They see like applications dropping to some extent. They see like less money coming in from their donors because they have become on some margins crazy. And every donor that I talk to basically says, I don't want my children or my grandchildren to go to an Ivy League university. And that should show up that there's a demand. And I think hopefully the supply will change a little bit, but it is complicated, Nick.
Well, you know, I agree. And without going too deep down the road of talking about higher education, I speak as somebody who has degrees exclusively from state universities and up through the doctoral level. And I came out of school with a very little debt, partly because I was able to pay my way through. It's harder to do that now, but I most people who take out loans, and it's about 70% of undergrads take out some kind of student loan, but most of them have debt that is under $10,000 or $11,000. When you see average, median, et cetera, I mean, a lot of people are managing to get very good, high quality educations relatively inexpensively. But I think you're right. And I think, you know, part of what we're dealing with here, and this is a broader topic that I would love to broach with you, is that what college meant in an American context, and of course it means something different if you're in England or France or Germany, or if you're in Latin America, is the you know, it changes over time. And we had one model in the burst of wealth and income increases after World War II and status increases. You know, I think it's going through a change now. And in that sense, this is a broader question for you regarding students. You know, it seems as if throughout much of the world, the system that, you know, the kind of social, political, economic system that's been in place since the end of World War II, and including, you know, the end of the Cold War, but also the decolonization period, is breaking down. So in the United States, we have things like the rise of Donald Trump and a series of unstable majorities in Congress where the Democrats run the House and the, you know, the Senate for a couple of years, then the Republicans get it back, then it flips over. In England, you have, you know, Brexit and a kind of breakdown of a traditional party system there. In France, you have Emmanuel Macron, who, you know, phenomenally became a leader without an actual party behind him. In places like the Middle East and North Africa, you have the Arab Spring and other actions going on. In China, there's been a massive liberalization of the economy since the end of the Cold War. There's change of leadership in places in Africa, such as, you know, South Africa. All of this seems to be what I'm getting at. And in the U.S. and the college situation, it seems that people don't need college or don't necessarily want the college that their parents or grandparents had. There's this exciting sense that we're in a new era, we're in a new world. That's both exciting but worrying. Is a common thread among your students all over the place that they recognize we're in a watershed historically? And what are the things that you think need to happen for liberalism, classical liberalism, the idea of limited government and individual freedom to kind of become the background basis for political economy going forward?
That's a fascinating question. And I think it has a lot to do with polarization and what is the reason for that. So I believe that politics has learned over time that the more polarized you are, the clearer you can speak to your own base, and it's really beneficial for your own votes. Meaning, if you can alienate the other side and play into your camp and like this we versus us kind of thinking, it really helps politicians, and we see this playing out in the examples that you have just given with France, the United States, etc. And we know from the data that polarization is on the rise, not only in this country, but in the West in general. And civil discourse is breaking down. For instance, if you go back and read the Federalist Papers, there were really incredible high stakes in the debates, but people discussed in a very civil way. And the feelings were, of course, like really ramped up, and there was like so much at stake for the future of this country, but people still respected one of the opponents, or at least tried to do that. And this is largely gone. If you just have to switch on any kind of news channel and see how one side talks about the other. And that is just so disconcerting, I think. And that really leads to bigger problems, because then you cannot really have like a reality check, because the right thinks that they are completely correct and the libertarians think they're correct, the left thinks they're correct, but not talking to one another to have a reality check. And so the solution that Students for Liberty is employing and that I'm trying to really push and what we're trying to be better on is, yes, our students are very educated and we're selecting them if they understand the ideas of liberty. And yes, they're getting some stuff on campus done. However, we also want them to be kind human beings who can talk to somebody with opposing viewpoints in a respectful way. That is lacking in Congress. That is lacking in the media. That is lacking on campus. And I hope that our students learn this lesson and build more bridges and show like, look, there are other ideas out there that you can engage with that might have like solutions to social problems which are different from yours.
Do you feel when we talk about classical liberalism or libertarianism, is it a fixed set of policies, or is it a kind of matrix of ideas that are going to change and adapt slightly, at least in their application, from era to era? Because one of the things that I find really interesting and refreshing and energizing about Students for Liberty is that it's a different cast of characters than if you go to a lot of libertarian meetings, not simply because people are younger, but, you know, it seems like there are more women involved. There are people from different parts of the world. Does being a libertarian in Brazil or Argentina or Cuba, does it mean something different than it does, say, being, if as opposed to a libertarian in Germany or in Italy or the United States?
So there were two questions in there. The first one was if classical libertarianism gives you like a set of policies. I would say not. Like my main reason, and I have many different reasons, but my main reason why I'm a classical liberal is because I don't know what is best for everyone. I don't want to be in a position where I have to rule over 320 million people or 81 million people in the case of Germany. I don't think I have the solution to every social problem, but I trust people and I know that complex social problems can be solved through different institutions voluntarily. And we need a system that allows for trial and error. And the error part, allowing for that and not like just shutting everything down just by regulation or by like letting the government step in. And this is how markets work. This is how civil society works. And the United States is the best case. I mean, Tocqueville has written so eloquently about the beauty of the American system where people come together in churches and other civil organizations and really tackle problems of poverty, of education of the poor or like people who are unfortunate. And this is super powerful. And this is what really lends me a lot of trust for the ideas. And so not about like, oh, we should just get rid of like taxation from one day to the other, which might be like libertarian policy if you want to depict it like that.
So the ideas are stable or you know, the basic framework, but then it's going to change in its application depending on time and place.
Yes, you have the insight of Hayek about like the differences between time and place. You have a humble approach to the ideas. You understand that society is complex, and if you just let's say we would implement the Second Amendment from one day to the other in Germany, we understand that there's a very different history, and we understand that there's not the same kind of education about guns and the same kind of appreciation for like how dangerous it might be. And I think if you would do it from one day to the other, it would lead to a lot of problems. But if you do it like gradually and you have like institutions that emerge, that is like a much better approach. That's like one example. Mm-hmm. I have a very strong belief in the price system. So I think the policy of free markets is a very desirable policy. But for instance, if you get rid of like all regulation that have accumulated over decades in this country from one day to the other, I mean, you will not have like a perfect free market and everybody would earn like so much more from one day to the other. There will be some struggle. I think it will still be a good policy, but we have to acknowledge that there is always like a bumping into one another within a free society because we have to figure out better solutions to complex problems.
How do you, what about the issue of the kind of broad diversity? I mean, it's geographical, it's racial, it's gender, it's sexual orientation, it's age of Students for Liberty. I think you guys are at the forefront, really, of bringing in a different cast of characters to the libertarian movement. One of the things that people, you know, and I say this as a kind of old timer in the libertarian movement, I can remember 20 years ago people saying, well, libertarian ideas can never really be that popular because, only smart people get them. Only people, you know, who are educated can get them, et cetera. You guys certainly don't buy that, right? How do you bring in such a, how do you cast such a wide net for the people who are interested in the ideas you're discussing?
Yeah, you're right. And I don't think everyone has to be like a super intellectual and has to have read Ostrom and Buchanan and Hayek to understand that. But I think our common friend Matt Kibbe summarized it very nicely. Don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. Like, how easy can a philosophy be? And I think most people get on board with that. And that's the reason why we have like positive slogans like peace, love, liberty. I mean, it's straight off the Bible, many other religious texts, and many people, it resonates with them. Or don't tread on anyone. It's not only about me, but it's about people, my community, my family, because that's what people care about. And acknowledging that, I think that gets you a long way with different ideologies, besides like just stressing how we are different, just trying to find common ground and then work towards like solutions to problems and comparing the means towards that. That, I think, I would encourage more. So nobody, like not everybody has to read all of these huge treatises that you and I probably have read.
I, spend at least 20 minutes a night memorizing my Mises before I go to sleep. Ed, you know, it's it, by the way, it's better than Ambien or, you know, heavy drinking to put one to sleep. Let me talk a little bit about your, you know, you have a PhD, and that's no small thing. And let's talk a little bit about your intellectual and ideological genealogy. Your dissertation studied the rise in the United States of what you called Christmas tree laws. And you note that laws are being passed more quickly, but also they're getting longer. What are Christmas tree laws, and what do they tell us about you know, the poor state of serious policymaking in the United States?
Yeah, I will tell you about that, but I just had like one thought as well, because we talked about education, the value of that. Even though I've learned a lot through my PhD and I learned a lot about grids and applying oneself to like a problem for many, many years to solve it, I think most of the skills I honestly have today is because of Students for Liberty. And because I was a volunteer for the organization in Europe, and I've learned to build a team, to organize conferences with 300 people, to fundraise money, to train other leaders. And all of these experiences, no internship program and no university program could have given me. And this is really what I'm using now day to day. And that's why I'm also like very passionate about the organization, because it changed myself. Mm-hmm. So education, you need also an application of things that you're learning. And that's what universities are failing mostly on, to a large extent at least. Going back to your question, so I've studied the patterns of lawmaking during financial crises from the 1970s up to the Great Recession, the most recent one from 2008 onwards. And you described the pattern, which is that laws enacted after crises in response to crises get enacted quicker, which is duh, like it's obvious, like government has to do something, not from our point of view, but from a society right. point of view, unfortunately. However, they also become lengthier, in average 10 times lengthier. In the Great Recession, it was 14 times lengthier with the American Recovery Investment Act, Dodd-Frank, and all of that. How do you explain that? You have less time. You have a complex problem like a financial crisis, which has a myriad of different reasons behind that. But how is Congress able to really push like these huge laws? And that was my empirical finding. And then I just wrote a bunch of chapters ranting about the reasons behind that. And you mentioned the Christmas tree laws. So my thesis, and other people need to study it more, and I have more anecdotal evidence, but it needs to be empirically more backed up, is that there is no time. Legislators want to signal to the electorate because everybody's calling them. There's a lot of pressure on them. The media asks them, like, what's the solution? They have a lot of pressure on them, and they want to signal to the electorate and to society that they are the right people to solve this problem. Therefore, they're going back to their staff, and they're going back to their favorite bureaucrats and say, like, okay, what do we need to do? And then those folks go back to their shelves and look there, and everything that they wanted to implement in the past and couldn't pass, now is the time. Maybe some of these policies get at the problem, but many of them are just like old laws that they wanted to implement anyways. And maybe you have like a good core within the law and that you want to pass, but the more ornaments you hang on the Christmas tree, so to speak, the harder it gets for a principled congressman like Justin Amash, who's also going to speak at our conference,
right.
to argue against that. Because then he said, like, oh, you just want to like make people more suffer, and like people are bankrupt, they need money, they need help, we need to regulate. And you have a harder time arguing against that, even if you're principled. But everyone is throwing so much at the law, barely people reading it or not understanding the significance of it. And then they pass it, and it's a huge success. And I have like some anecdotal statements of politicians that like, I had no clue what's in the law, and I just wanted to pass it. And everybody said, like, we need this now, and there's a lot of pressure on them. And that's how these laws getting bigger and bigger. But it is very, very unlikely from my point of view that this process generates laws and policies that actually get at the heart of the problem of a financial crisis.
Is that a function? And I know in your work you talk about there are various kind of actors in this play, in this drama, and one of them is voters, one of them is the media, one of them are, you know, politicians themselves as well as bureaucrats. How do you address that, or how do you slow that down? And I'm thinking, you know, just as you were talking about stuff, I can remember, the deliberations over the USA Patriot Act, which was passed, you know, shortly after the 9/11 attacks. And that was clear. Nobody read the bill. I don't, you know, even the people who typed it up weren't reading it because it was so, everybody had to rush through it, et cetera. There was no lengthy deliberation. Nancy Pelosi famously said about the Obamacare bill, the Affordable Care Act that, you know, we have to pass the bill to see what's in it. You know, this is it continues on. I mean, it was clear that, you know, the Republican tax bill was not particularly well vetted. And again, sometimes these laws are better or worse, but there seems to be something strange if you're not deliberating over what's on a bill or if you're using it to throw in everything in the kitchen sink. What are the main causes? Because we've always had crises in the past. Why is there such a kind of surfeit of Christmas tree laws now?
It's multifaceted, and you mentioned like the groups that I've studied, voters, interest groups, and bureaucrats. And let me just hone in on like one aspect of this. Something that I don't think that many pundits really fully realize is the power of bureaucrats. What I've learned in my studies is also that politicians very rarely come up with like a great idea and then drive the policymaking process. Bureaucrats are very, very proactive. So they come up with laws, they pitch it to politicians. So they are there at the inception phase. Then once like you are in the lawmaking process or like the bill is in Congress, then you have them there for the interpretation. So they give feedback to the politicians and tell them like what to nudge. And then when it's passed, they implement it and they interpret it. So they are very powerful players within that. And we are living already like in a technocracy.
Yeah.
And from a democratic standpoint, one might question that. One might also raise questions if this is like the best way of coming about with policies. Sure, you need people with expertise, but there's like very little transparency in that. And the extent to their power is really, really fascinating. I mean, give you an example. Dodd-Frank, the law that tried to fix the whole financial system after the financial crisis, while not even talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is ridiculous because they were such an important player within the crisis. This law, now, 2018, it's still not fully implemented because the law in itself was just like a bunch of descriptions for bureaucrats to come up with the rules. If you're living in such an environment, if you're a banker, like, how do you do business? You cannot really anticipate the future. You have to keep track of a myriad of different government regulation agencies and so forth. It's really hard to do business in such an environment. And you can see that in the data. It used to be that every year dozens of banks were founded. And when I did my research, like there was barely one or two every year because you cannot operate in that environment. And now banks are like even more centralized and even more clustered
right.
than they were before the crisis. So let's say we have a huge government debt problem. We know that. We have a huge student debt problem. Interest rates are currently rising a little bit. Like the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, like how do they unwind? Like if the next financial crisis comes, like what then?
Yeah.
It's a really disturbing and thought.
Well, this is, and now we shift maybe from Hayek to somebody more like Franz Kafka, where, you know, regime uncertainty, where, I mean, virtually, and I think it's worth taking it out of the context of kind of Orwell or, you know, a kind of throwback to the Soviet Union. But it's more like Kafka, who was, you know, if nothing else, was a bureaucrat and was a a kind of writer about what is life like under a bureaucracy where you know somewhere, somehow you are breaking a law that may or a rule that has never really been articulated or enforced before. But I know some of your work talks about kind of regime uncertainty or legal and political uncertainty where if you don't know what regulations mean, you can't you kind of get frozen up. You don't want to invest money. You don't want to act in a certain way. And then occasionally you do get people who just say, screw it, let's do it. And, so the people behind Uber and Airbnb, for instance, you know, take a huge risk to say, OK, we're just going to do this. And then we're going to try and figure out how we justify it when bureaucrats or when state, local and federal governments come after us. But it's not the best way to run a society, is it?
It sure is not. And I mean, everyone who talks to entrepreneurs gets a real sense of that. I just recently talked to one of our donors and he has a biomedical startup. And just because of one tweet of Hillary Clinton basically threatening to regulate that industry, his stock plummeted and it went bankrupt. If there's so much uncertainty within a business just by one tweet, like this is just crazy. And this kind of thinking is not original to me. Robert Hicks,
right.
the
yes.
economic historian, he wrote about that with the Great Depression. And he made the argument that the Great Depression was, of course, not solved by spending billions and billions of on like guns and going into World War II and all that spending, it was solved because policy uncertainty was reduced. And with that, he means that politicians became less threatening to business people. There was business people felt more confident that if they put their time, the resources, and the capital into a business venture, that they will be able to reap the fruits like 5 years, 10 years down the road. But if you have like somebody like Roosevelt in the White House, who's like threatening business people and say like how evil they are and coming up with like this flurry of regulation and new agencies, of course you cannot invest. And my co-author Adam Martin, who is at Texas Tech, and I, we made the argument that something similar happened during the recent crisis, the Great Recession. And we said like because of the PPACA, Obamacare, because of Dodd-Frank, and because of regulatory agencies being so active, there was very little trust in the system. People were afraid of higher taxes and they didn't invest. And that showed up in survey data, that showed up in behaviors and statements. And now, and that's a good thing about Trump, even though he doesn't understand free trade and is not very economically principled, at least his regulatory agencies were not very active so far. And you have like low levels of regulation right now, in like one measure. And you can see businesses are more optimistic. They see like taxes are going down and they're excited and they want to invest because they have like more trust in the regulatory system. But markets are very volatile. There's a lot of competition. Things change all the time. And if you add to that a layer of complexity within politics and like Congress is doing all kinds of stuff and regulatory agencies are doing all kinds of stuff, business becomes very, very hard. And the data shows that.
Yeah. And I would only add that we saw this under George W. Bush and a Republican Congress as well earlier in the 21st century, where he passed a lot of major laws, including tax changes, which generally, you know, reduced taxes, but also were unclear and were temporary. He introduced Medicare Part D. He introduced major education legislation. He was the one who got the bailouts going, and he introduced what are considered economically significant regulations at the highest rate since Lyndon Johnson. Plus, you know, political uncertainty and kind of geopolitical uncertainty because of 9/11 and whatnot, as well as our elective wars both in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, the 21st century. And I guess let me use this to lead into a final question. You know, what we have seen in the 21st century, really, partly because of economics following from political actions and foreign policy issues and just global politics in general, the 21st century has been very uncertain. Regimes are toppling, regimes are changing. The American government, you know, seems to be just piling on regulations, both, or kind of. Bizarre actions and kind of arbitrary changes, partly because of this instability of political majorities. Do you think students or younger people today are growing up in a particularly uncertain time? And does that lead them? I mean, what is the best argument then? If times are uncertain, what is the best argument for a kind of libertarian or classical liberal approach as a way forward?
I think you're right. People feel uncertain, and there is a correlation in like developed countries that you have like a lot of wealth, but still people are not very happy. And we have to ask ourselves like why that is, because the world has become so complex and people don't know where they will go, where life was much simpler back in the day, because like if your father was a farmer, you will be a farmer, like this sort of thing, you know. So we do have to have an appreciation that these things are changing. But I, for one, even though we see these changes and there's uncertainty, that I still think that the American dream and the ideas behind that are still very much alive, independent of this country or abroad. I fundamentally believe if you find something that you're passionate about and that you want to work towards, that you can succeed. And I chose my way outside of Germany because I saw more and more opportunities out there. And for the most part of my life, especially my teenage years later on, I was very insecure and I didn't really believe in my skills that I have much to offer to the world. But Students for Liberty specifically like showed me that and put me in charge of my own life. But right now, especially in the US, like so many people are, especially young people, are cuddled. Like everybody gets medals. You cannot, like parents get imprisoned or like thrown in jail because their 9-year-old kid played alone on a playground or insane things like that. And of course, these kids then complain the same way they've complained in school, or they complain to their parents, complain to the bureaucrats in the universities, and they don't know any other way. They have never been empowered or put in charge or had to deal with difficult situations. I'm, of course, painting with broad strokes here,
yes,
and I don't want to generalize too much. But acknowledging that, I think there's so many more opportunities out there, and showing that to people is my job. And I want young people to have the same kind of experience that I did, that they learn that they can produce a lot of value. And that's the reason why virtually all of our events are executed by our students. And last year we had over 500 with 30,000 attendees. And each time, like, a team of students learn something new. Maybe they fail, but they learn something: marketing skills, organizational skills, leadership skills. And looking at these individuals, sometimes 22 years old, and just last year we had Aubrey, one of our leaders in the United States, being on Fox News, being very eloquent, and seeing that they have these skills and that they challenge themselves and do that, it's very uplifting, and that makes me optimistic. We, of course, only a drop in the bucket, but I hope that if more people see that self-fulfillment and challenging oneself in one society, that's like an integral part of the libertarian philosophy. If more people get excited about that, then they can grow themselves and society in their countries.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Wolf von Lahr. He's the head of the Students for Liberty. Go to Students for Liberty online. Google it, search it, and check out LibertyCon, March 2nd through 4th in Washington, D.C. Dr. Wolf, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Dr. Nick, thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.